accession number 24928, reel 2.
I'm interested that you should talk about these young blokes who were already prepared to go off, presumably before the war had been declared.
Well, we weren't, quite frankly, anticipating going off to war per se at that stage. It wasn't until war was declared that we thought, well, here we go, we'll go overseas and fight for king and country. We were prepared to do it, there's no doubt about it. But why, I don't know. It was all a great big adventure, being in the army as such. I mean, I had a ball. It got me out of Dalgetty's.
What was the feeling being in the militia? What sort of feeling did you have about yourself? How did people look at you?
Well, you had camaraderie, you had mates, you had the opportunity of doing things that you never would have ever had a chance before. If you worked your guts out, you could get promotion, which I managed to do. I got promoted to a lance corporal, which I held for some months until I plotted my copybook and they ripped it off.
You can talk about that. But how did a young chap feel dressed up in uniform?
Pretty proud. I was in the Scotties and I used to have a kilt, wore a pair of footy shorts underneath it, thank you. I wore a kilt and I had a sporran, I had spats, and I had a rifle, bayonet, the whole works. I used to go home at the weekend with that after the do. I used to go to town in all my glory. People used to think it pretty marvellous, really, and we used to sometimes go for a march through the town as a battalion. And it used to be pretty impressive with the pipes and that sort of thing. It was stirring stuff. Yeah.
You mentioned the Scotty Highlanders, the 2nd 28th, 2nd 16th. Mm. How did they mix together or not?
Yeah, well, we didn't work together as per se, but we got on okay because most of the fellows that were in the 2nd 28th were mates with the fellows in the 2nd 16th. But
did you know Keith Potter, who had been at Hale, I understand?
Yeah,
well.
Keith used to be our, he was our, at Hale, he used to play the taps and last post and that sort of thing. I think he's dead now, isn't he?
Still pottering around.
I think it was the same Keith. Did he mention the fact he used to play?
He used to play drums of some description, yeah.
Play that, yeah.
I believe. Yeah. He was in the 2nd 28th, obviously, you'd go off to fight in the Middle East. Mm. I'm interested, was there a competition between the different battalions?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know that.
So as the situation grew grimmer, mm-hmm. 38 turns into 39, and then obviously September 39, mm. war is declared. What do you recall of September 3rd?
Well, that's when we're all hauled up together as a battalion, and the CO told us that we are at war.
Did you hear Menzies on the radio?
No, I never heard him. No. But we are at war. And immediately we were put onto a war footing. And we were issued with live rounds of ammunition for our rifles. I was allocated an area to look after with a lot of my mates out on the west end of Rocknest. And we were taken out there and dumped and told to look out for battleships or whatever, any odd boats. How the hell we were going to get word back to base, I don't know. It had to run a couple of miles to get that information back. We used to have to patrol the township at Rotto. There was a strict curfew, and anybody that was roaming around was supposed to be either bayoneted or whatever.
Like the lock-up.
Yeah.
There can't be much of a township on Rotten back in
1939. No way. I can't even remember how much there was. There was a bakery and there was a barracks, which we didn't use. There was the area where the people that looked after Rocknest, they had their houses. On Rocknest, they had 9.8-inch guns, which we were given the job of putting down the rail tracks to the guns. The gunners were there. They lived in posh circumstances compared with us. I can't tell you how many people were on Rocknest, but there weren't very many.
How did your family look at the fact that the war had been declared again, only 20 years on?
Yeah. Well, I think it was a big worry. I know my mum felt a bit apprehensive, and we had friends in Northern who were the type of people that they'd get together practically every weekend, and we'd see them or they'd come to see us. We had friends in the district, and they were all worried about their sons or daughters, what would happen. And I can remember coming back from Perth down to the farm and saying to the family one weekend, I've joined the Air Force. And of course,
how did that happen?
That was like a lead bloody balloon going down. And I can remember Dr. Beamish saying, well, really, you're a bit young for that, aren't you? I was only just 18 or then.
Tell us, how did you come to be involved in the Air Force?
Because we all volunteered to go away to war as the 16th Battalion, and we were told by the colonel that that could not happen because the policy was, at the time, there were brothers and cousins and uncles and all that mixed into the battalion, and they didn't want that to happen. So I joined the Air Force in 1940.
What was the reputation in relation to the different services? And obviously the Navy, Infantry, Army and Air Force.
That was a fascinating situation because the Air Force wasn't held in very high regard by the Army or the Navy. When I was in the Air Force during my training, we were called Menzies Mannequins, which caused some fights occasionally in odd places.
Blue Orchids was another one.
Yeah, Blue Orchids, Menzies Mannequins, and something Cowboys. But we soon put that to rights. But I was in the Air Force Reserve first up in 1940. My Air Force number was 406220 as 220th to join up in WA. We were sent over.
What was involved in joining the Air Force? What did you have to prove, as it were?
I went up to the recruiting centre in Perth and said, I want to join the Air Force. And they gave me a bit of paper and said, how old are you? And I said, oh, old enough. And how old are you? And I said, well, I was 18. You'll have to get your parents' signature. So I took it home and handed it over, and that was it. I was immediately put onto the reserve, and that's when the fun started. I was on the reserve for, I don't know how long, a few months. And during that time, I learnt the basics of airmanship, learnt the Morse code. I learnt how to send and receive Morse code. I don't know, I learned a lot of other things too. One of the things that we all did was to go into the post office, the GPO, most evenings, where the old boys would teach us the technique of sending Morse code. These old boys who used to communicate with the eastern states. Due to their efforts, I ended up pretty good. I could send 28 words a minute and receive about the same.
I'm interested to find out, what were your ambitions in the Air Force? What did you want to do in the Air Force?
I wanted to be a pilot. And we were all called up one day for a medical, and I don't know what happened. We were all pulled up for a medical, wanted to be aircrew, and I preferred to be a pilot.
Why?
Well, because I thought pilot would be beaut. So they put us through the medical, and I passed, and we were then told that we would be sent over to the eastern states to Summers in Victoria for an initial training course, the ITS. I think that was very early in 1941, to Summers in Victoria.
Before we get to that point, obviously there had been this sort of period of what people now call the phony war between 1939 and then the invasion of France in May of 40. What did it feel like in this particular space?
I can't tell you very much about that. The only thing that I can think of is that we're burning our guts out to get over and get on with the job.
When there was this blitzkrieg that came about,
yeah.
How did people begin to feel about
it? We thought it was a pretty poor show, yeah. We thought it was a bloody awful thing to happen. And quite frankly, I can remember my family and my grandmother saying how awful it was that the people in England had to put up with this sort of thing, and the people in France had to, but everything would be all right because the Maginot Line had stopped them, and it didn't. And when the countries began to fall, well, that really caused big upsets amongst the old people back here.
I'm interested to know what the sort of propaganda had been about the Germans and the sort of the old Bosch. Up until May 1940, and the ease at which they had literally gone through the whole of Western Europe.
Yeah, well, I don't think that I can remember anything like that. You see, in the First World War, they used to depict Germans walking around with a baby impaled on the end of their bayonets and this sort of thing, but I can't ever remember anything like this ever happening here in WA. No.
My assumption would be that once you see things or hear things like Panzer tanks and Air Force blazing across the skies in Western Europe, that you'd be certainly concerned about who you were going to be up against.
Oh, yeah. We didn't have an Air Force here, but we did have Avroanson aircraft, and we did have Hudsons and Tiger Moths and those sort of things, and we'll get to work with them. I mean, we were pretty naive, and it quite frankly, it wasn't until I arrived in the Middle East and saw what was happening and that it woke me up. And I thought, a sad thing it was back in Australia that they put their faith in such things as Whirraways and Hudson bombers and that sort of thing. What they could have done about it, I don't know. But at the time when I was going into the Air Force, I used to look at a Hudson bomber flying over and say, wow, one of these days I'll be in one of them. Thank Christ I never was. They were awful aircraft. Some of my friends who became pilots flew Whirraways and were shot down very quickly up in the islands. No. The Air Force was a non-existent thing to begin with. And it wasn't until we got away and into the actual turmoil in Europe that things began to look up a bit for Australia, because they began to get aircraft out here that were useful.
What was the feeling, or was there a feeling, that Britain might actually lose at the time of Blitzkrieg, of Dunkirk, those sorts of things?
To me, that never entered my head. It never entered my head, I don't know why, but it wasn't that I thought Britain will eventually win or anything like that. That sort of thing didn't enter my head. I don't know whether it entered anyone else's head in my group either. We wanted to get away and have a crack at doing our bit.
The situation then, you're sent off summers for training. What was the feeling then? What was it like to head off?
It was terrific. I went away with must have been 80 odd of us that were sent over there, and it was a terrific feeling. It was rather emotional as far as the family were concerned. I can't sort of go much into that because I can't remember very much, but I know that it was a very emotional situation. We left the Perth station to join the Kalgoorlie Express to take us up to join the Trans-Australia.
What was the atmosphere like at Perth station heading off?
It was absolutely fantastic. There were hundreds and hundreds of people to see us off. I think that amongst them that came to see me off, there was an uncle, my father couldn't get down, and my granny came to see me off, Granny Hill. But there are a hell of a lot of other people that I knew that came to see us off. And then to get onto the train, all these young bucks getting on the train, we severed our ties with all responsibilities, and off we went, and we really behaved like we'd been let off the chain. a lot of my friends at the time were from Dalgetty's and Goldsbrough-Mort's and Elder Smith's, and they had friends who were on the line on the way up, and they used to, when we'd pull in at a station, at a railway station on the way up, there quite a lot of these used to be there to cheer us on. One of them was a fella with us, was a fella called Cummins, and his auntie ran the place that made beer in Meriden. When the army went over, she always gave them kegs of beer to look after them till they got to Kalgoorlie, and then they had to put the empties on a train back to her. When we were going through, she put on a keg of beer for us when we got to Meriden, and we consumed that on the way to Kalgoorlie. That was very nice. All this sort of thing was something. And it was the completely different atmosphere of being on a train, away to the big adventure, as it were. Terrific.
What sorts of things do you recall talking about amongst your mates in relation to what was being left behind and what might be on the horizon?
Well, we talked about what we were going to do, how we were going to cope with doing things in the Air Force, what we were going to do in the Air Force, wondered where we would go to. I didn't really care where we went at the time. All I wanted to do was to get into the Air Force and get into an aeroplane.
It concerned you that you might never come back.
Never thought about that. We were invincible. That's silly, this, but this was the feeling. You felt like that. It wasn't until you really got into the actual pretty bits that you really worried your guts out. Oh, yeah.
I'm interested to talk to you about the whole Empire Air Training scheme, how that had come about, and it was agreed that rather than sending pilots off to help, that you would be trained along the other dominions. What was it like to be in the Empire Air Training?
Well, we didn't understand very much about that. All we knew was that we were Empire Air Training. We didn't realise what it was or how it came about or anything. It wasn't until afterwards that we realised that it was all money donated by Great Britain and Canada and South Africa, I think, and all those other places to help train air crews. A lot of the training was done in Australia, but a lot of the blokes were sent over to complete their training in Canada. I think some of them were sent down to Rhodesia, but I don't know how that happened. It didn't happen from here. I think the Rhodesians were probably in the Empire Air Training Scheme, and they would have come from maybe South Africa, something like that. But the Empire Air Training Scheme was all over. Yeah.
One of 10,000 Australians committed as air crew for the actual scheme. What was involved in arriving at Summers, and what did that training involve, the further training?
It was called basic training. You marched, you did Air Force law, you did Air Force mapping, and you learnt the navigational problems. You learnt a certain amount of physics, which was interesting, and you learnt your Morse code, sending and receiving. And this was possibly part of my downfall, because I was so bloody good at radio. At any rate, that's another story a little later on. At the end of your empire, your training at Summers, you were then allocated as to whether you would go to pilots or whatever. Well, they discovered that I wasn't very good at arithmetic. That was a big problem. I still think that I could have done very well as a pilot. They decided that it would be best if I was sent to number one WAG school at Ballarat.
Number one WAG school, sir.
Wireless Air Gunners Training School. I've got a thing in here, so I thought I had a thing.
What was it like then to find out that you weren't going to be a pilot?
It's very disappointing. However,
what sort of reputation did Wireless Air Gunners have in relation to a pilot?
Again, this was a funny one. One of the things that was instilled into us at Summers was that if you are in an aircraft, you are a crew. And every member of the crew has a responsibility. And this was emphasized time and again. There were some pilots later on, we came across a lot of them in the Middle East, and they were Royal Air Force types, who treated their crew like dirt. When it came to treating Australians like dirt, those said pilots didn't get a very good deal out of them. We were treated like dirt when we got to the Middle East, but that's another,
we'll get to that,
another story. I don't know whether you're going to be able to do it tonight. I feel like a cup of tea.
Okay, that'll do it for today anyway.